from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. 150 years ago, in June of 1864, the horrors of the Civil War continued to mount. Each night, President Lincoln took in the reports. 18,000 troops killed in the Battle of the Wilderness. 18,000 more at Spotsylvania. 12,000 dead at Cold Harbor. 8,000 at Petersburg. And yet, on June 30th, 1864, Lincoln turned away ever so briefly from all the death and destruction to claim for the nation a place of exquisite beauty and peace. He claimed Yosemite. How that remarkable moment happened 150 years ago and what Yosemite still represents today is the story we'll take up next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The people who first lived there called themselves Awanichis. The highest waterfall was called Cholok. Their ancestors first arrived 7,000 years before. But in the spring of 1851, their time in what would become known as Yosemite was short. They were driven out by American troops, and the quest to control Yosemite Valley and its future began. But what that future would look like was by no means clear. Giant sequoias could easily have been logged, the valleys packaged and parceled for sale. Why that didn't happen is actually one of the great stories of American history, a story that depends on some extraordinary characters, a few stunning photographs, an astute junior senator from California, and a president who, amidst the horror of the great Civil War, 150 years ago, June of 1864, signed a piece of legislation that preserved Yosemite, though not for the people who first called it home. We want to talk in this hour of Forum about what happened 150 years ago, why that happened, and where we are now with this fantastic national park and what it holds for all of us for the future. We're joined in our conversation first by Dayton Duncan, writer, documentary filmmaker, and author of Seed of the Future, Yosemite and the Evolution of the National Park Idea. Dayton Duncan, good morning.
Good morning.
Happy to have you join us. And joining us as well, Shelton Johnson, Yosemite National Park Ranger. He also performs a one-man show, Yosemite, through the eyes of a buffalo soldier at Yosemite Theater. He's been a park ranger at Yosemite for many years. Shelton Johnson, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
A little bit later in our program, we'll get some other views of Yosemite as well. Dayton Duncan, first, sort of take us back, if you would, to that time of 1850. I was describing the people who first lived there, and then the Mariposa Brigade arrived in the spring of 1851. What happened next, and set the stage for us for this really remarkable story that would unfold over the next 15 years?
Well, 1851, California was still in the grips of the, what would be earth-shattering, obviously, to the native peoples of California, and actually earth-shattering to the future of the United States, the California Gold Rush. And as a consequence of the Gold Rush and all the people, you know, flooding into California, it was actually what took place was the worst slaughter of native peoples in American history. Part and parcel of that was a brigade was set in under the ironically named Major Savage to find the people living in this valley that no white people had yet seen and take them to reservations. Now, part of that was, you know, they're it wasn't all just meant for cruelty. Part of it was a notion in some people's minds that that would be a better place for native peoples to be so they might not be, you know, slaughtered quite so easily. But anyway, so in 1851, the Mariposa Battalion, it was called, because it was based out of Mariposa under the command of Major Savage, entered what we now call the Yosemite Valley. And one man was transfixed by the beauty of it and wrote about it, while the others were more intent on burning out the homes and the supplies of the Indians and driving them out. And when news of that place started being published in California newspapers, a chain reaction began, that here was waterfalls that were, you know, 10 times the height of Niagara and a beautiful valley. And later news, you know, came that here was another group of those stupendous sequoia trees that hadn't yet been cut down. And this chain reaction finally got to 1864 and a bill before Congress that said, for the first time in all of human history, that a special place like this, a large tract of beautiful, majestic scenery, should be preserved not for royalty, as it always had been, or for the very rich, as it always had been, but for everyone and for all time. And that is when, though there are, you know, the idea of this had been percolating for, you know, for some time, but that act of 1864 was really the beginning of the national park system.
And Shelton Johnson, as someone who, as an African-American park ranger, but someone who's also of Indian descent, when we think back upon that time and the people who first called it home, to what extent is it important in this celebratory year of remembering 150 years ago what happened to preserve Yosemite to also remember what was lost and what we still need to do to make sure that that heritage is not forgotten?
Well, the thing to keep in mind is that the indigenous people were the first caretakers of the area that eventually became Yosemite National Park. But, of course, the military was brought in beginning in 1891. And their role primarily was to safeguard the park. And when I say things like that, people are confused. Like, why would you need to safeguard a mountain range or safeguard a valley? But it's not so much the safeguarding of a valley or a mountain range. It's essentially the safeguarding of an idea, a new idea, the idea of national parks, which basically its infancy was in Yosemite Valley. And so when you have a new idea has to be protected because people don't really understand what that means, and they do what they tend to have done for decades. So folks were, you know, people that lived in the area were venturing up into the Sierra Nevada. They were shooting the deer. They were cutting trees down for firewood. But once the Yosemite Grant was passed, that was disallowed. That became illegal. And for people that were living in the area at the time, it probably didn't make much sense because, again, it was a new idea. So the Army was brought in, you know, beginning in 1891, to essentially protect this idea in its infancy. And so these soldiers essentially became some of the first park rangers, and about 10% of those soldiers were African American, and that story was the story that essentially was forgotten. And so when you think about Yosemite, it's not just a place. It eventually became a national park, and these soldiers eventually became some of the first park rangers, and many of those soldiers, at least 10% of them, were African-American, and that's the story that was lost in that early time period.
And we'll come back and talk more about the role of the so-called Buffalo Soldiers and the attempts to preserve that part of Yosemite's heritage, not only the role of African-American soldiers, but also Native peoples as well. But I want to step back to what happened in the 1860s, Dayton Duncan, and the role of someone who, honestly, I'd never heard of before, the junior senator from California, Senator John Conness, who was received a letter urging him to take some action to survey and perhaps preserve Yosemite. And he took that up and he went to the Senate floor. And as you write about in your book, it's sort of one of the most clever, politically astute speeches I think anyone ever gave. And here's why. Because, as you know, he says, I will state to the Senate that this bill proposes to make a grant of certain premises located in the Sierra Nevada and the state of California that are for all public purposes worthless, but which should constitute perhaps some of the greatest wonders of the world. It's so interesting. But he was smart, right, Dayton Duncan, to sell the Senate on the idea that, yeah, there's really no value here.
Right. I mean, it's I love that. And Conness was obviously very, very clever. The up until that moment in American history, the business of Congress was disposing of public lands. You know, give it away if even necessary, but sell it to homesteaders or give it away to homesteaders. as they just started in 1864. Give it away to the railroad companies. Put it to use. Alexis de Tocqueville in the 1830s had noticed very astutely, that said the Americans will always prefer the useful to the beautiful, and they will demand that the beautiful be made useful. In other words, that's what we did.
And you noted that at that time, at least, that the Census Bureau's policy was that once two people settled an area per square mile, then it was considered, quote, redeemed from the wilderness and brought into the service of man.
Right. I mean, it's hard for us today to completely, we sort of understand that commerce and conquering nature is still very much part of what goes on in the United States, but it was the main thing in the 19th century. Yeah, if you took a forest and cut it down, that's how you, quote, redeemed
right.
it
right.
From nature. Or if you dammed up a river, you were redeeming a river. It wasn't. Yosemite is part of this whole process that includes John Muir, of course, that finally convinces that maybe it was the opposite. That we can be redeemed by wilderness rather than that we can redeem wilderness.
And part Kness of that
knew that I was just going to say, Kness knew that if he was going to sell this, if Congress at that time thought this has got valuable minerals, if they thought, boy, there's a lot of great timber there, if they thought that it was, you know, they knew it was sort of had harsh winters, it's up in the foothills of the Sierra, might not be that great for farming. So he said, don't worry. It's not, you know, it was worthless for those purposes, but for national pride and also for underlying, it was a little bit of commerce. He had been suggested by a steamship company that he make this proposal, and they were obviously interested in the tourism angle of it all. But he convinced the Congress that this is something we've never done before, but it's not really that valuable land, so let's go ahead and do it. And there wasn't actually all that much debate. They also, the selling point as well was that there were these huge trees in the Mariposa Grove, and the United States had been sort of embarrassed by the fact that when the first sequoias were discovered in the Calaveras Grove and other places, the first things that people did was cut them down and send parts back east so they could convince Easterners and Englishmen that there really were such huge trees out in California.
So we're at this interesting point where our ideas about what has value and the way in which we look at nature and at wilderness are beginning to change. And so we want to fold another part of the Yosemite story into this at this point. And joining us to help us do that is Elizabeth Kathleen Mitchell. She's the curator of prints, drawings, and photographs at the Cantor Arts Center at Stanford, which currently has an exhibit of the photographs of Carlton Watkins. The Watkins exhibit runs at the Cantor through August the 17th. And his photographs, Elizabeth Kathleen Mitchell, played a role in this story, too. He came to Yosemite Valley in 1861 with 2,000 pounds of photographic equipment and a dozen mules to take pictures. And what did he capture that began to also make a difference in the way in which we view that pristine landscape?
There's a way in which Watkins, you know, he wasn't the first photographer to enter Yosemite, but I think there's a way in which that he made portraits of Yosemite. He wasn't just documenting the landscape. He made portraits of natural features that really conveyed the character of the place. And when those, because his photographs could be printed as multiples, they were exhibited in Europe. They obviously traveled to the East Coast. He really set the standard for how people understood that place to be.
And what then how did those photographs begin to make a difference, not only in terms of our attitudes, but also our politics? We don't know exactly whether or not Abraham Lincoln saw them, but we think he might. How did those photographs perhaps have a role in getting that piece of legislation that Senator Kness, as we were just describing, authored on its way in Washington?
Well, you know, if you can imagine, these photographs were circulating on the East Coast, and particularly in Washington, D.C. They were shown in New York in 1862. We know they were in Washington, D.C. by 1863. John Kness owned a set. And if you think about that moment where the Civil War is raging. And certainly in New York, in Washington, D.C., they saw plenty of photographs of Civil War battlefields. To have these images of this Pacific Eden that was so calm and so perfect and beautiful beyond imagination that, you know, the photographs definitely helped motivate the legislation. And by doing that, it made a promise, I think, to the American people that when the country is again unified, this land is here for everyone, not just North or South, East or West. It's for all Americans. And that's an example of great foresight.
Elizabeth Kathleen Mitchell, the curator of prints, drawings, and photographs at the Kenner Arts Center, which currently has an exhibit of Carlton Watkins' photographs. It'll be running at the Kenner Arts Center through August the 17th. Stay with us as our conversation continues. But let me now turn back to Dayton Duncan and Shelton Johnson to give us that sense of that moment in time. And I want to broaden out this idea of the value of the wilderness beginning to sort of settle into the American psyche at this time. Dayton Duncan, of the horrific Civil War, as you write about in your book, this time where daily Lincoln was getting reports of 18,000 dead at the Wilderness, 18,000 more at Spotsylvania and so forth. What do you think was going on that perhaps resonated with him and with the American public that at this particular horrific time in our history, we also needed to reach out and preserve something that was beautiful?
Well, we don't know for sure. You have to be honest about that in the start. We don't know if Kness had ever been to Yosemite. Certainly there's no evidence that he had. But this is the same time that in the same sort of within a year or two of all this, they also passed the Homestead Act, which is an act of faith in the future. They passed the Transcontinental Railroad Act, which was something that was going to bind the nation east and west. While North and South were still bitterly divided, they signed an act for public colleges as well. And this is sort of in that mix. It doesn't come directly out of it, but it comes out of this interesting stew, I think, of where a lot of great American ideas come from, and we don't know exactly from whom. But it is the stew that it combines commerce, it combines national pride. This was our way of saying to the old world, to Europe, you've got ancient temples. We have a cathedral out in the west that has its own sacramental waterfalls coming down over stupendous cliffs. You've got the pyramids. Take a look at these trees. They're as old as the pyramids, only they're living things. It was a chance for us to sort of, you know, thump our own chest. To be honest with you, I think what we would now call conservation or environmentalism was hardly on the radar screen at all. We understood, people understood that places of beauty were good for the soul and good for contemplation and good for your health. And they knew that because everybody who was rich, you know, was busily buying it up.
Yeah.
Central Park was now being created in New York City. But out of all of that came this idea, and Kness put the bill forward, and he said it was suggested by, as he called them, certain gentlemen of California, without naming them specifically. That this ought to be set aside, entrusted to the state of California, but saved for everyone and for all time. And that's the only place you can really put your finger and say, here's where it begins. Obviously, there are roots to our relationship to nature with the transcendentalists, Emerson and Thoreau, with Thomas Jefferson, that this is an empire of liberty that we're trying to create on this continent. But this is the moment. And this is the place. Yosemite is the place, and 1864 in June is the moment when it first germinated, first took seed, and then was planted.
And Shelton Johnson, I'm interested in your views on this and whether or not you also connect. You said that this was an idea that needed to be protected, and it comes about at roughly the same time, of course, as the Emancipation Proclamation. And we struggle so in our current time with the idea of places like Yosemite being open and involved with people of color and making sure that that heritage is available to everyone. And as an African-American park ranger, I'm just interested in whether you connect the dots between these great ideas that took place at that time, that the creation of the national parks, the Emancipation Proclamation, the seeds, as Dayton Duncan was saying, that even go back to the Declaration of Independence and the pursuit of happiness. Do all those align for you in some mysterious way, I guess, in Yosemite?
I don't think the way is mysterious. I think the way is fully illuminated.
Mm.
I don't see dots that are to be connected. I see streams or rivers that flow together, that there is this congress between the two, that there's movement between the two. Because when you think about democracy, by definition, it's about freedom. And when you think about the Emancipation Proclamation, by definition, it's about freedom. One is an interior sort of freedom. The other is an externalized version of freedom. But they both flow together. They're both interconnected. So I don't see a separation. I see a union. And when I think about the African Americans and what we have undergone as a people over the last 400 years, and then I think about the national parks, I think about Yellowstone or Yosemite or the Grand Canyon, I just see a different expression of freedom, from one that's very personal becoming one that's more cosmic. But they do definitely connect. They do definitely flow from the same place. And I think that when you're in a place like Yosemite Valley, you actually can experience that and you can see it. And it's not just a democratic principle that is solely cerebral. It is a democratic principle that's tangible, that's in the air, that's in the light, that's in the soil beneath your feet. You can feel it against your skin. It's something that's very tangible. And that's part of the wonder of places like Yosemite or Zion or Grand Canyon or any of the national parks. This whole notion of freedom, of democracy, is something that's very real. It's something that you can put to your lips, you can breathe in, and you can derive sustenance from it.
Shelton Johnson, Yosemite National Park Ranger. He also performs a one-man show, Yosemite, Through the Eyes of a Buffalo Soldier, at Yosemite Theater. He joins us along with Dayton Duncan and Elizabeth Kathleen Mitchell. We'll get some other views in just a moment after our break on the history and saga and story of Yosemite National Park, which had its beginnings in June of 1864, 150 years ago. Before we go to our break, Elizabeth Kathleen Mitchell, this idea that was so worth preserving, is that part of what you hope people get when they come to the Cantor exhibit, that they see it as Watkins saw it for that first time almost 150 years ago and or slightly more than that, and that that idea is still so important to preserve?
Oh, absolutely. When we came up with the idea for this exhibition, we knew it would be very popular, particularly the section of it devoted to Yosemite. But I had no idea that people would come in and spend hours just in that section. I've actually seen people dragging each other to photographs, hopping up and down. And when they knew I was in the gallery, dragging me over to their favorite picture. Like this, people, the history is resonating, the visual experience is resonating. And that's really remarkable in an age where we're so saturated with photographic imagery, that for these photographs to have such an immediate, tangible effect on people is really wonderful.
The story of Yosemite, a story that began 150 years ago when Abraham Lincoln signed the Yosemite Grant, story, of course, that goes back thousands of years before that for the people who first lived there. We want to hear your stories about Yosemite. What's your favorite place in Yosemite? What's your favorite moment there? What has it meant to you? We'd love to have you join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can post your thoughts or memories on our Facebook page or email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the story of Yosemite. It was 150 years ago, in June of 1864, that President Abraham Lincoln signed the Yosemite Grant, which made Yosemite Valley and Mariposa Grove, the first parkland that was ever set aside by the federal government, although it was handed over to the state to do the actual guardianship, I guess you would say. And Dayton Duncan, author of Seed of the Future, Yosemite and the Evolution of the National Parks Idea, one of our guests. Dayton, there's just give us sort of a quick answer on this, that people always point to the fact that Yellowstone, of course, was the first national park created in the 1870s. That was in part because Wyoming wasn't a state, and so someone had to run the park, and so it was the national government. But your view really is that the idea really began in Yosemite.
There's no question of this. 8 years later, in 1872, when Congress was confronted, as they had been in Yosemite, with dramatic photographs, in this case by William Henry Jackson, of this wonderland known as Yellowstone, the greatest collection of geysers in the world, where mud boils and steam spouts out of the ground, and an incredible series of waterfalls as well. If you look at the testimony as they're contemplating what to do with this wonderland, they make constant references to Yosemite. We've already done this in Yosemite. We're just going to do the same thing here. And then they say, but wait, there's no state to give it to. At that point, it had Wyoming been a state, and we can all, you know, say our silent prayers tonight that it wasn't in 1872, they just said, well, there's no state to give it to, so we'll just create a, quote, national park. It was really as much by happenstance as by design that Yellowstone therefore becomes the world's first national park. But its DNA is 95% Yosemite. And the interesting thing is, like as in all evolutions and mutations and so forth, the first mutation there in Yellowstone was a national park, but when it came back, you know, 30 years later or so, 25 years later or more to the Pacific coast, they decided that this national model was actually probably a better one than a state model. And so a fight ensued. They created a larger Yosemite of the High Country National Park in 1890. And finally, in 1906, after a very big battle, the state of California was persuaded, with the help of President Theodore Roosevelt and a progressive governor in California, that the valley itself and the trees should also be made part of a national park. But that was just that idea that was planted in the valley and in the Mariposa Grove coming full circle. But the thing does begin in Yosemite. I have good friends in Yellowstone, and they won't throw me into a mud pit if I come and tell them what I just told you.
Dayton Duncan, the writer and documentary filmmaker, author of Seed of the Future, Yosemite and the Evolution of the National Park Idea. We'd love to hear your stories about Yosemite. What has it meant to you over the years? What is your favorite place there? How has Yosemite been something that's been transformative in your own life story? You can tell us your Yosemite story at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Let's take a call from Alan in Berkeley. Alan, go ahead.
Oh, hi. It's nice to hear this show. It brings back a lot of memories about visits. I guess I'd start off by saying my parents went to Yosemite on their honeymoon back in the 40s. And that was quite a story with a lot of memories about it, people talking about it all the time. Later on, when I was in Fresno, I had a chance to travel up to the valley. And with the class, we did a geology survey. So a lot of mixed feelings and activities going on at the time, but there's a lot of good memories of the quiet evenings, the nice river flowing through in the fall. You know, it was kind of not many people. It's nice.
Alan, thank you. Thanks for joining us and telling us that story. Of course, a lot of people have also camped in Yosemite over the years, and one of them was Teddy Roosevelt, who went camping with John Muir at a moment that was important in the history of Yosemite. And we're joined now by Lee Stetson, who is an actor and has played the role of John Muir for more than 30 years as part of a show that goes on at Yosemite Theater. Lee, thanks for being part of our program.
Dave, thank you for the invitation.
And tell us a little bit about that famous camping trip when Teddy Roosevelt came and John Muir took him out into the woods and valleys and mountains of Yosemite. What happened? Describe a little bit of that and maybe a little bit of the conversation that they had.
Well, it was extraordinary, of course, that Roosevelt has never been to the Western Forest, which he was now responsible for as he as he became president. And so he was impelled to invite John Muir to spend 4 days with him and 3 nights camping in the wilderness of Yosemite, essentially alone with a couple of guides to help prepare the campfire. But they spent their evenings both in the Mariposa Grove of Big Trees, which, of course, was part of the grant, as well as on top of Glacier Point, which was just barely part of the park at those days, and then again in Bridavale Meadow the following night. And so they discussed many issues relevant to Yosemite at the time, including the Hetch Hetchy and animal rights, of course. But one of the main topics of conversation certainly would have been and was the Yosemite grant, in particular the fact that it was not included then, as well as the valley nor the Mariposa Grove of Big Trees was excluded from the national park in those days.
And would you, Lee, do a little bit of John Muir for us, perhaps, and what he might have said or did say to Teddy Roosevelt during that camping expedition?
Well, sure. One of the productions that I'm currently involved in Yosemite involves the Tramp and the Rough Rider, the two of them camping together, and Muir would turn to Roosevelt and looking down from Glacier Point into this stunningly beautiful view of Yosemite Valley, and he says to the president that being asked why Roosevelt asked him why he wouldn't support the idea of that becoming part of a national park, and Muir's response is, because down there in the Lord's grandest gardens, the state commissioners have permitted and encouraged such incredible abuse and neglect. Shabby buildings, butcher shops, liquor saloons, lumber yards, even a hog pen, the stench of which floats to the tops of the walls in a rising wind, and the meadows. Every meadow in that valley is fenced, and all the flower people trampled by horses and cattle. Tin cans and other rubbish lay about for all to see, as if it were precious silverware exposed for sale. And despite all of this abuse and neglect, the commissioners are actually trying to persuade Californians that if the valley were given back to the federal government, the state's sovereignty and honor would somehow be lost, as if you'd immediately remove it, half dome and all, to Washington, D.C.
And he won, and he carried the day. Teddy Roosevelt came away from that conversation and that camping trip moved and inspired and determined to make sure that it was preserved, right?
Exactly so, and happily so. It was clearly not appropriate that the park, the valley floor, and the Mariposa Grove of Big Trees would be utterly surrounded by a national reserve, and Roosevelt saw the wisdom of that, of course, and helped to make the change.
Lee Stetson. Yeah, go ahead, Dayton Duncan.
I was just going to say, I think that is the most important camping trip in United States history, and I'm a person who's written 3 books about Lewis and Clark. But that particular moment brought together this great prophet of conservation and the wilderness, John Muir, who was the voice of this new thought of redeeming us by wilderness versus us redeeming wilderness, the greatest president for conservation in our history, and man, what I have loved to have been, you know, the person tending those fires while those two guys were talking.
Right.
A few days after that remarkable camping trip, well, almost immediately afterwards, Roosevelt signed something to his Secretary of Interior telling him, we need to expand the national forest, a national forest down to the area that is now Kings Canyon National Park, and up by Shasta as well. And then he started immediately working on trying to get the valley and the Mariposa Grove added to the national park. But he gave a speech in Sacramento in which it almost sounded like John Muir could have written it for him, and has one of my favorite of all Roosevelt lines, which is said, "We are not building this country of ours for a day. It is to last through the ages." Mm. Now, this is a guy who's just seen that remarkable granite outcroppings of Half Dome. This is a guy who just camped at the foot of the grizzly giant in the Mariposa Grove, a tree that was, you know, closing on 3,000 years old, I guess.
Let me hold you there, if I might, Dayton, because I want to get in some other views from our callers as we continue this wonderful conversation about how Yosemite came into being, how it was preserved, and the role that John Muir played on that wonderful camping trip, as Lee Stetson and Dayton Duncan are describing with President Teddy Roosevelt. Lee Stetson, thank you for giving us your rendition of that camping trip with John Muir, and thank you for all the work that you're continuing to do to showcase that at Yosemite Theater. Thanks for being part of our conversation.
You bet. Thank you.
We want to go back to some of our calls and hear more stories about what Yosemite has meant to you. Sally joins us next in San Francisco. Sally.
Hi. I've had many personal moments at Yosemite that were important to me, but the one that stands out and is important, and one of your callers talked about the healing, the importance of healing in nature, is last March I took my 24-year-old daughter at her request for her birthday trip up to Yosemite. My daughter is on the autism spectrum, and one of her challenges is calming, to be calm and to feel some sort of sense of peace. We were taking an early morning walk up to the lower Yosemite Falls and standing on that lowest bridge and just listening to the water. And at that moment, a life's nose started falling. I'm going to cry. And she reached her hands upward and placed her face so the snow would touch her face and was listening to the water. And I have never seen such joy and peace and calm. It was a blessing.
Such a great story, Sally, on many levels. You're a dear, dear old friend. Thank you so much for calling on this show in particular and for telling us that story about Chloe. Sally,
thank you. And thank you for this show.
Yeah, thank you. Shelton Johnson, talk about that some, about what you have seen, the sort of joy and peace that it can bring to someone like Sally's daughter that perhaps you've experienced, that you've seen in other children, perhaps children who have come from other challenging backgrounds as well.
Yeah, and I think that I should start out also by saying that, you know, when John Muir met with President Roosevelt in Yosemite in 1903, the park was under the protection of the Buffalo Soldiers. And when you see that famous historic photograph showing President Roosevelt and John Muir standing together, there might have been a Buffalo Soldier out beyond the frame of that image. And so it's important to have this fuller restoration of this history that we're celebrating so that it is inclusive of people who were there, but were not necessarily recognized to be there. And then as far as the last comment that woman made about that wonderful story of what was happening, I should point out that happens on a daily basis in Yosemite. You can just walk to the base of Lower Yosemite Fall in the springtime, and what I find far more fascinating, yes, this may sound heretical, but far more fascinating than actually seeing the beauty of Lower Yosemite Fall is seeing the effect of that beauty on the faces of the people who have their heads up, you know, swung up to the sky looking at it. And that those looks of transcendence are so commonplace in Yosemite Valley, so commonplace at Glacier Point or up in the high country. It's that becomes the look that is a mirror that reflects the divine, that reflects our perception of the divine. And this is a 19th century concept, but it's rooted in today. And so what I'm saying is that it is commonplace to see such rapture in people's faces when you're in Yosemite. And I enjoy just looking at people looking at Yosemite because it's almost like you have to use this averted vision to see something that perhaps we're blessed to see, and maybe to some degree, I don't know if we're worthy of seeing it.
Yeah, One of, you know, hearing you say that, Shelton, makes me also think of this, one of the many quotes I've read from John Muir about Yosemite in which he says, no one can escape Yosemite's charms. It's an equal opportunity provider, I guess, in that way. We're joined now also by Scott Gedeman, Park Ranger spokesperson for Yosemite National Park, who is coordinating and publicizing all of the 150th year anniversary activities at Yosemite. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us something more about sort of how you are opening up, I guess, Yosemite and making sure that kids from all backgrounds experience exactly what Shelton Johnson and Sally were describing.
Well, we're really proud to have an extensive outreach program here. Of course, people come to Yosemite from all over the world, but one of the things here in California with such a diverse population is we try to make the visitation and the visitors to Yosemite reflect the diversity of the population in California. So, for example, we've got a wonderful program with the University of California at Merced, where we have the Yosemite Leadership Programs, where we have students from UC Merced that work up here in the summer from families that, you know, a lot of them are first-generation Americans that don't have a family background of going to national parks. And those students work here in the summer, and some of them are on their second and third year, and we're hoping that they get jobs here in the park and go on to be stewards. And so we really want to get that outreach and make Yosemite accessible for all people.
And Scott, is this moment in time at Yosemite, 150 years after the grant was signed, is the park itself at a kind of crossroads as it goes forward? We think of its vulnerability with the Rim Fire last summer, with climate change, with the ongoing debates that often Yosemite is a part of in terms of how it's used, with the preservation or development of the parkland and camping spaces and the Merced River, and should we have swimming pools there or not, and all of that. Outline, I guess, some of what Yosemite itself is facing and must contend with if we're going to have another 150 years.
Sure, and that's a great question. And as you mentioned, with the Merced River Plan and a lot of our ongoing management efforts, it's all about a balance. You know, Yosemite belongs not just to the American people, but to the people of the world. We get almost 4 million visitors a year, and so through our planning efforts and things that you mentioned, also things like automobiles and traffic and parking and things like that, you know, our goal, first and foremost, of course, is to preserve and protect the park. But at the same time, we need to provide the access and provide for the meaningful experiences. So by things that we're doing, restoration projects, for example, for the 150th anniversary, the Yosemite Conservancy is helping us fund a wonderful restoration project at the Mariposa Grove. We've removed parking areas. We're consolidating parking areas. We're restoring meadows. So we really feel that as we become more enlightened, if you will, about natural processes and how to manage the park, we're able to still provide the access for those 4 million people, which will inevitably grow, but at the same time, retaining that natural beauty, retaining the beauty of the waterfalls and the cliffs that everybody so eloquently spoke about. And we feel really good about that. And that, again, is our goal as we move forward to make Yosemite as beautiful and accessible and preserved for the next 150 years and beyond.
Scott Gettiman, Park Ranger, spokesperson for Yosemite National Park. Scott, thank you. We still have time for a few Yosemite stories at 866-733-6786. Let's take another one from Chris in El Cerrito. Chris, go ahead.
Yes, hello. Wonderful program. One of the most thrilling experiences of my life I had in Yosemite. My wife and I went there one winter. We stayed at the Ahwahnee and hiked through the valley. One day, it was sunny and the sky was clear. We were hiking up a switchback trail on the north side of the valley, roughly across from Half Dome. And the massive scale of this huge granite cliff that we were climbing made us feel like ourselves had shrunk to the size of a gnat. It was an amazing experience. But then, in the midst of that, we heard a booming sound, which we thought was thunder. But as I said, the sky was clear, so we were mystified what was going on. And then we looked across the valley and down the slope of the north-facing side began avalanches, huge, these massive storms of snow falling down into the canyon with this terrific booming sound. And it was just, you can imagine, it was transformative to be there and realize how tiny and how insignificant we were in the face of this tremendous natural place.
Chris, thank you. Thanks for telling us that story. Terrific story. Thank you. Bill in Mill Valley is next. Bill, your Yosemite story, briefly if you could, please.
Yes. I lived in the Yosemite Valley in 1982 and worked in the Ansel Adams Gallery. So I think he should be also mentioned with some of the preservation that went on.
Absolutely, yep.
But my story was with John Muir up on Sunnyside Bench, and maybe those guests that you have know about that particular spot that John Muir would hike to, which is to the right of Yosemite Falls, not the Yosemite Falls Trail. So you have to hike up Sunnyside Bench, and you get to what's called Fern Ledge. And he hiked up there, and you stand beneath the falls. You go out on the 7-foot ledge, and he was standing there looking up at the falls, and the wind shifted in the valley and blew all of Yosemite Falls in his direction and poured over his body, and he clung to the face of Yosemite Falls, almost getting blown into Yosemite Falls and falling to his peril. And he had many adventures like that. He'd surf the sequoias in windstorms, and as I was there that 6 months working in the gallery, I did pretty much pattern my hiking and all my adventures after what he did, which I learned from Lee Stinson. Stinson at the time when he started his play, I believe in 1982.
Yeah, great story, Billy. I'm glad. I'm glad you've told it to us. I'm glad you're safe and that you didn't get blown down off of the falls. Yeah, thanks so much for that story. Let's hear another one from Shoshana in Berkeley. Shoshana, a quick story, please.
Our family has been going to Yosemite for generations now, and so I think of Yosemite and I think of our family, and in particular I think of my grandpa Gene. It was a really special place for him, and I think he went with his parents as an adult, and our families continued to go for years. And if I remember right, I believe my grandpa was in his 70s when he did his last climb up Half Dome, and he was pretty proud of that and would always tell us about it. And and I remember, you know, driving in with him along the river and him just, like, pointing out and calling out the names of these amazing places. Bridal Veil Falls, there's Glacier Point, Three Sisters, Yosemite Falls. It just has so much meaning. And our family still goes, and we're going again in a couple weeks, and I'll be pointing out those places to my kids. So.
Great story. Thank you, Shoshana. Thanks so much. One more from Risa. Hey, Risa.
Hey, Dave. How are you?
I'm fine.
So Gary and I had our honeymoon in Yosemite, and ever since then, my whole family has come up there together. Maybe we did it for the last 30-some-odd years. So the magic is there, and it continues, and I want to wish you all the best.
Thanks, Risa. Thanks so much for calling. Let's get a last story from each of our guests about what Yosemite means to them, what it represents, where they most find the truth, I guess, of the Yosemite experience. Quite quickly, if you can, please. Dayton Duncan.
Oh, that's tough. I'll pick for the sake of it. Every place is special there. But I would pick the Mariposa Grove. It's impossible not to stand in the presence of a living thing that is 2,000-3,000 years old, so huge, that you don't feel that you're in the presence of something, some great wisdom, and some great connection. And as one of your earlier callers say, you feel insignificant. At the same time, you feel this equality. This is what Muir felt. Everybody's equal. Not every human being, but all living things are connected to one another, and you can really feel that there.
Shelton Johnson.
You know, I think that when we look back at some point, our descendants will see the Yosemite Grant as a sort of declaration of interdependence, the sense that all things, both living and non-living, are connected in some way. Whether we can see it, whether it's perceivable or not, those things all flow together. And when you're in the valley, you feel that, and you don't have to be told it because you can experience it for yourself. So for me, just thinking about being in Yosemite and working in Yosemite, it's just literally a transcendent experience for me to be there and to have that place around me, for much of my life now, and that's a very wonderful gift.
Shelton Johnson and Dayton Duncan joined us this hour talking about the great Yosemite story. I'm sorry we don't have time for a last word from Elizabeth, Kathleen Mitchell, and Scott Gadiman, but we thank them so much for their participation in our program as well. But we must come to a close because I have to say goodbye. After today, some of you know I'll be moving on to focus on a new documentary film project as well as some new duties at the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research. And while I hope to be back from time to time to fill in, I've been thinking a lot this past week about work and life and the dreams that we all share. Not long ago, I was sitting at a baseball game when a fellow in the row behind me said, "Doesn't the guy in front of us sound a lot like Dave Iverson?" To which the person next to him said, "Who's Dave Iverson?" It was one of those great little moments when you're reminded of what counts and what doesn't, that the recognition the microphone brings is fleeting at best, and that what matters so much more is what we do with the microphone, that we tell the stories that need to be told, that we give voice to those who need to be turned, that we shine a bright light on the community of which we all are a part, and that we just listen to each other. So I want to thank the management and staff at KQED for choosing to be committed to those values. And I want to thank you, our audience, for holding us accountable to that mission. And most of all, I want to thank my wonderful colleagues at Forum who believe in that mission with their whole hearts. To our compassionate and insanely dedicated senior editor, Dan Zoll, thank you. To the remarkable Michael Krasny, who has been so unfailingly generous to me, thank you. To our producing team of Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lorberg, and Amanda Stupai, you are all such a joy to work with. Thank you. To our engineer and my marathon running coach, Danny Bringer. You couldn't make me fast, Danny, but you kept me on the air. Thank you. And perhaps most of all, to our late great executive producer, Raul Ramirez, who always believed in the best of which any of us could offer, including the possibility that a TV and film guy like me from the Midwest might have a few possibilities as a radio host. Raul, thank you. And so let me say one last time, thank you to one and all. There are so many more people to thank, including my daughter, Laura, who just emailed me with her favorite story about Yosemite. Thanks, Laura. Thanks to everyone. But as the music begins to play, let me also just say one last time. The Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lorberg. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai with able online assistance from David Marks. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Dan Zoll is our senior editor, and the executive producer of Forum will truly always be Raul Ramirez. Thank you, everyone. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.